A quick note before we begin. This is a serialized show, so if you haven't already, go back to the prologue and start listening from there.
When the bomb happened, we're supposed to be playing a gig at Kuta Beach. We are already halfway going to the gig, to the venue. I heard so many ambulance coming, police, but I thought it's an accident or something. We don't know there's a bomb explode just a few hundred meters in front of us. People panicking and everybody screaming and running. There's a bomb! And then we so panicking and try to contact everyone. It cannot work because all the phone shut down on that time. We come to Made's house and then everybody panic because the news is already on TV. Made's mother, she was crying because it's like only me, Danki, and some of the crews are back. Robbie and Made is not, cannot reach by phone on that time.
Hi, I'm Eva, and this is a soundtrack of Resistance, a podcast looking at the social history of Indonesia through the songs of Navicula, the best band you've probably never heard of. This is the second of a two-part episode on violent religious extremism through the songs that the band released as a response to bombings and violence that shook Indonesia during the 2000s. You heard Gembul at the start of the show. Gembul was Navicula's drummer at the time. We'll come back to the rest of that story at the end of the show. I'm going to start today's episode with another story. It's about a guy called Budi. The story is from Budi Si Berani Mati, Budi's Not Afraid to Die, one of the songs Navicula released during this time. Budi is a very common Indonesian name. It's as common as John or James in majority English-speaking countries. Budi in Indonesian can also mean reason, character, or morals. Budi is living away from home. He's been away from his family and his beloved younger brother for many years. And Budi finds himself in a situation where he's alone, unhappy, unsatisfied, and he's got many problems in his life. Budi becomes part of a community through which he becomes indoctrinated by misinterpreted and extremist religious teachings. He finds meaning in the faith, and this becomes the strongest force in his life. Budi goes on to believe that in the name of his faith, it's his calling to eliminate the enemies of his religion. He believes these enemies to be Westerners and non-followers of his faith. Through the song lyrics of Budi's Not Afraid to Die, we hear how Budi's heart has died and all the love from his heart has gone and is instead full of deep hatred. Budi now believes that the purpose of his life is to defend his religion, and this gives him the courage to die for his faith, so that he can eliminate his enemy. The target is decided upon, a busy nightclub. One night, he walks into the club carrying a bag of disaster on his back, a bag filled with explosives. As Budi enters the door of the club, setting off the explosives, he believes that he's entering the door to his heaven. What Budi doesn't realize, because he's lost contact with his family, is that his younger brother works at this very club. But it's too late. The bomb destroys everything. And among all the bodies of the victims of Budi's crusade lies the lifeless body of Budi's brother. The song makes a reference to a common Indonesian proverb, Nasi sudah menjadi bubur, which literally means the rice has already turned into porridge. There's nothing you can do to fix it. What's been done, what's been destroyed, cannot be undone. And this refers to the violence inflicted by Budi, by the bomb he set off, which resulted in massive destruction, the deaths of hundreds of innocent people, including not only his perceived enemies, but also other people of his faith, including his beloved younger brother. The story of Budi in the song Budi Si Berani Mati, Budi's Not Afraid to Die, is about the terrorist bombings that shook parts of Indonesia during the 2000s, the deadliest of which was the bombing in Bali that killed 202 people on the evening of October 12, 2002. Three bombs were detonated that night, One was carried into a busy nightclub inside a backpack worn by a suicide bomber. The story of Buddy also gives context to Aku Bukan Mesin, I'm Not a Machine, the song we explored in the previous episode about how people can become indoctrinated with misguided religious teachings and literally become killing machines. In today's episode, we're going to try and understand how and why people become violent religious extremists and explore Everyone Goes to Heaven, one of the songs Navicula released about a particularly turbulent time in Indonesia's history. I'll be speaking with Heidi Arbuckle, an expert on tolerance and the role of music and the arts in creating an informed and tolerant society. But first, I'm going to continue my conversation with Sydney Jones, a widely renowned expert on conflict and religious extremism in Indonesia, to get her perspective about the current situation and whether violent religious extremism continues to be a threat in Indonesia. Hi, Sydney. I wanted to ask you, why is it that people join an extremist movement or group? Are there particular characteristics, a profile? How does that process happen?
Extremist groups that want to see Islamic law applied in full in Indonesia are generally not the groups that get involved in terrorism organizations. The people that join terrorism organizations come from a variety of different backgrounds, but there's not a systematic progression from being conservative to aligning with Saudi Arabian ulama, for example, and adopting a kind of Wahhabi viewpoint, to getting engaged in violence. There are different trajectories to those two groups. So if we're talking about violent extremists, the kind of people who joined ISIS, the kind of people who joined Jamaat Islamiyah in the past, there isn't a single profile. There are as many motivations for joining almost as there are individuals, but there are a couple of kind of broad groups. You get some people who join because of a misguided humanitarian impulse, people that want to come to the aid of oppressed Muslims around the world. So that's one factor. You have people who are looking for a sense of community. Some people who have come from a difficult home situation, for example, who are looking for a new kind of family. And sometimes they're attracted to these very tightly knit clandestine organizations. But then you also have people who are joining because they believe that it's important to work for an Islamic state and to operate under Islamic law. So if you look at the Indonesians who joined ISIS, it was overwhelmingly for positive reasons, not for injustice or discrimination or any kinds of grievances, but it was the attraction of a Muslim state that brought people to join. Very different in conflict areas. We were talking about Ambon and Poso and some of the areas where we'd seen communal conflict in the past. In many of those areas, it was the desire for revenge or the desire to regain lost property or indeed a sense of injustice that you didn't have in other parts of Indonesia. The one thing that is not the major driver of violent extremism in Indonesia is poverty. It's the biggest myth in Indonesia and also in many other parts of the world that poverty drives radicalization. Just think, if that were true, Indonesia would be a seething mass of violent bombers, and it's not. Poverty is not the major factor, and it means that economic development will not make terrorism go away. I think this is one of the biggest misunderstandings of the terrorism phenomenon in Indonesia and in many other places more generally.
So if it's not economic development, what works in preventing violent extremism?
I think if anybody knew the answer to that, we would have successful programs around the world, and we don't. But I think there are certain kinds of initiatives that have proved fruitful. And one of them involves mentoring of prisoners and their families. So once people have been arrested for terrorism, men, but increasingly now women as well, they are basically a literally captive audience for programs to try and both understand why they became radical, why they joined a movement, to work with religious counselors. It's got to be somebody that's got credibility and legitimacy within that movement. But there are many individuals who have actually come out of the ISIS movement with religious credentials, but have decided that it was no longer a legitimate movement. And some of those people have become very effective counselors of newer people coming into prisons. But you've got to have this mentoring relationship and a commitment to work with them and their families over a long period of time. I think there is also an effort that can be done through schools, through careful teaching of values from a very early age. I think it's important to note that all hardline groups of almost any religion, whether you're talking about evangelical hardline Christianity in the United States or radical Islam in Indonesia, they start young and they see preschool groups and kindergartens as being the place where you've got to start indoctrination. And that means that Indonesia has got to start counter indoctrination in terms of preaching tolerance and openness from a very early age. But if you look around and you understand some of the fights that have taken place in local communities over elementary school textbooks, for example, you realize this is not an easy task to undertake.
You mentioned Indonesians that joined ISIS, and I understand that Indonesia had far fewer people per capita joining ISIS as compared to other countries. Why is that?
If you look at why Indonesia had fewer fighters in Syria than one might have expected, I think you've got to step back for a moment. First, look at the fact that Indonesia is a Muslim majority state. So there's a big difference between Muslim majority and Muslim minority states, where you have immigrant populations that face neglect, persecution, failed expectations, neglect, and economic discrimination. So you start out from a different perspective when you're talking about a Muslim majority state, where those factors don't necessarily apply. Then you also remember that Indonesia is not beset by conflict. After the Ambon and Poso conflicts were resolved, after that, you didn't have conflict that was killing large numbers of people in Indonesia. You didn't have a repressive state the way you had in the Middle East or parts of South Asia, for example. You didn't have nasty neighbors stirring up trouble the way you have in the Middle East and in South Asia. And so the climate in Indonesia was far more conducive to the growth of various kinds of Islamic organizations, both positive, ones that played a moderating role, as well as what we call hardline civil society, or some people call uncivil society, where you had nonviolent but hardline groups that were very intolerant, taking advantage of democratic space. But that space was another factor that prevented some people from crossing over into violent extremism. So there are a lot of very complex factors involved for why you didn't have more Indonesians going to Syria to fight.
Do you see that the rights of minority populations in Indonesia are increasingly at risk?
Yes, I think that there is ample evidence from public opinion surveys of growing intolerance in Indonesia. And I think that it's become increasingly important for the government to take a proactive stance. So we've seen good actions, for example, by the Minister of Education issuing a decision that schools cannot force children of one religion to wear the attributes of the majority religion. So girls who are not Muslims cannot be forced to wear headscarves in schools. This is now a regulation where it's up to the individual what kind of dress is required by his or her religion. And that's a good thing in terms of promoting a moderate vision of Islam and a moderate, tolerant view of Indonesia more generally.
Do you think that most Indonesians see an inclusive and tolerant society as something that's desirable?
I think it's very interesting that the vast majority of Indonesians in public polls, more than 85%, I think, believe that Indonesia should continue to be based on Pancasila, which stresses pluralism, tolerance, compassion, social justice, humanity, and so on. But at the same time, there is growing evidence of this rising intolerance. So it's clear that there's a disconnect between the image that people have of the Indonesian state and personal attitudes toward people of other faith. And the task of the Indonesian government is going to have to be to try and bring those two together, to take the desire for a state based on these very good values and translate that into a society and a government where minority rights are fully respected.
Thank you so much, Sydney.
Thank you very much.
Faith makes a man try to reach the Holy Land, but in the end, he's nothing.
I wanted to explore further the issue of growing intolerance in Indonesia with Heidi Arbuckle. She's lived in Indonesia for the past 22 years, has deep expertise on the issues of tolerance and on the promotion and protection of pluralist and independent perspectives in Indonesia. She used to lead the Ford Foundation's Indonesia program for creativity and free expression and is a longtime supporter of the arts and creative sector in the country. Heidi was in Perth, Australia when we spoke, so we caught up via Zoom. So again, sound quality, not great. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Ewa.
Thanks so much for joining. So what are you working on right now?
I work on a project looking at the issue of rising intolerance in Indonesia, predominantly focusing on strategies to strengthen resilience so that people can have the ability to be able to not be persuaded by ideologies.
You've been working in this area for a long time. What's your take on the state of tolerance in Indonesia?
Things like intolerance they're difficult things to measure. I think if you ask an Indonesian this question, most are going to say that they do feel like they're living in a more divided political and social landscape, ultimately. A good indicator is that everyone has a story to tell about that. Even myself, I'm married into a Christian Batak family, and there are a lot of stories about my nephews, now Muslim friends, who their parents are now anxious and concerned that if they play with Christian friends that it's not appropriate for them. And I think these things are quite new in Indonesia. This is something that, these are stories you wouldn't necessarily have heard previously.
There's a lot of discussion around growing Islamization in Indonesia. Are you seeing that happening?
There's quite well-documented growth in mosques and Islamic education institutions. I got very involved in culture and realised how important and powerful that is, especially in a place like Indonesia. And so I see it more from a sociocultural perspective where Islam has really just become the main expressions in Indonesian society, where it's rooted in the marketplace. It's infused in lifestyle, in fashion, consumer products. You can get Sharia hotels, Sharia housing estates. You can even buy halal pet food, I think, now. You know, there's an element of Islam there that's just become a currency. And it's in really high demand, right? And on the other hand, it's also become a political aspiration.
And does this threaten and lead to the marginalisation of minority groups?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at it from the perspective of minority groups, absolutely. I think one of the biggest issues has definitely been on the LGBT community, for instance. There's been really huge backsliding since sort of Indonesia's period of openness in the sort of early 2000s, where we supported expression of young queer people and also in the media. But you can't even have a safe public discussion on that issue anymore without the risk of backlash. No, it's also its effect on women and girls. The women and girls' rights are increasingly challenged because of this. Feminism, even the notion actually of gender equality is being challenged at the moment. There are very influential Islamic preachers out there who are telling women that their role is in the home to raise children and obey their husbands.
What do you think is going to happen in Indonesia in this regard in the coming years? Are you hopeful?
I absolutely am hopeful. Yeah, I have no doubt that you know Indonesia is going to work this out. Perhaps we're going to see, in terms of this overwhelming Islamization, I think it will certainly continue. I think that it's a very important aspect of young people's lives at the moment, but I don't think it's going to be as terribly divisive as it's been elsewhere.
So, Heidi, how can intolerance be addressed?
There's the successful approaches and the less successful ones, which I feel are more sort of punitive. And that's certainly been, to a large extent, the approach of the Jokowi government, the approach of repressing and censoring. But the ones that are more successful are often more difficult, like everything, because they need to be people-centred, they need long-term commitments. But I think really effective methods about strengthening soft skills. My current work, we did a lot of work on soft skills such as empathy and compassion. These are approaches we use with university students. In communities, we've got a really strong focus on strengthening local cultural identity and cultural practices, right? And so, again, this idea of building resilience to the more sort of narrow or singular identities that often extremist groups try to nurture. And then there's a large piece of work that we do on bridge building. It's creating safe spaces for people who don't normally connect with one another. It's about enabling human beings basically to come together and be able to see their shared humanity. There's a great example actually of in Indonesia, a group based out of Bandung called Kemuji. Kemuji actually means Komunitas Musisi Mengaji. And so it's the community of musicians who teach or preach. They responded to what was happening in the music scene in Bandung, where they felt that a lot of the independent music studios were closing down. You were seeing, you know, people were uploading videos of them, you know, smashing their guitars and declaring music as haram. And what Kemuji did was, rather than getting trapped in that sort of scriptural or theological debates, they came at it in an indirect way and said, well, music is a form of mengaji, which what it did was it blurred the lines between religion and culture and invited people to engage without them having to fear that they were doing something that was not permitted by their religion. Just a really great example of the importance of music in the arts for this kind of work.
So this is a good time to talk more broadly about the role of music and the arts in building a more tolerant and informed society.
Yeah, it is my favourite subject. It's such a great entry point to talk about these issues. So music and the arts are just fundamental to, if you're talking about building a tolerant society. One of the most incredible things, you know, about Indonesia is such an asset is that pluralism it's embedded in its artistic traditions. And what I mean by that is you can look at a single piece of batik cloth and there you can see how it brings together influences of Chinese and Javanese influence. You can look at mass dance and see how it's this mix of local belief systems, Islam and Chinese influence. These are things that on the internet are just completely divisive. The other thing about the arts as well is that some of these dances often allow for very fluid gender identities. And so for me, when I say the fundamental, that the traditional arts, they embody Indonesian diversity. And so it's just such an incredible entry point to be able to then understand pluralism. I think that is the power of arts for humankind, really. It's what it enables us to do is to have that emotional experience. But there is something definitely very powerful and unique about the Indonesian arts. And I think a lot of that is rooted in traditions and just how important they have been to Indonesia and Indonesians, you know, as a form of identity and expression. Yeah. Indonesia has this incredible contemporary art sector, right? And art in so many of its forms. Indonesia has been so great. It just pushing boundaries and challenging norms and imagining it through the arts. I mean, I loved hearing your story when you described going to a particular gig for the first time and you were just moved by this music. And this wasn't just any music, like this is music with purpose. And there's just something so powerful in that.
I wanted to pick up on Heidi's point how certain issues like religion, which can be extremely divisive on the internet and it's really difficult to have public discussions about them, these issues are able to be addressed and transmitted through music and the arts in a far less controversial way. I'm here with Robbie. Robbie, why do you think that is?
When we're talking about this sensitive issue like religion, ethnic, race in Indonesia, we cannot say it directly. If we speak in public or in media or in social media. But lucky me or people like me that have art as the platform to channelize our expression. I believe the role of an artist is to take care of human emotion. And then if we put the kindness into this process of taking care of the human emotion, I believe people can feel that. And then art is depend on your motive while you're creating an art. If your motive is because you really care and then touching the people's heart, then people will feel that. And then people trust that because you speak heart to heart. So it's very different when we're talking, for examples, like in the political program, especially nowadays, people easy to get suspicious. Maybe you got this hidden agenda. But when you speak in art, it's like heart-to-heart communication. So people can feel that. It's something that connects as a human to create a better society. Yeah, most of Navicula's song is inspired by what the reality that happens around us and also inspired by so many discussion among our community, the news. My position as an artist, I see myself is like a satellite. So all the inspiration, all the words is actually what we absorb or what we receive from environment, from people, from anywhere. And then we as an artist just reflect it back to the environment. Maybe it's the analogy is like positioning myself as a moon, you know. Moon is not the source of light, right? It gets received light from sun and reflect it back to the universe. So in my perspective, if you want to reflect more, you have to open yourself more. So more you receive, more you will reflect.
In a moment, we'll hear the song Everyone Goes to Heaven. But first, Robbie, can you tell us how you created the song?
During the post-Bali bomb situation, what I remember at the time is like it's a shock moment. Everyone in Bali strongly affected by that event. The impact to the society is really big. especially people in Bali, kind of like a open mind. But after the bomb, there is a big question among the community, and potentially this religion and ethnic issue become more and more sensitive. And some people, including us, that don't want this happen, want the society to see clearly that this problem create a more problem. We don't want create another conflict and turn Bali become more close-minded. So we're trying to say what is really happened related to this Bali bombing and terrorism without changing what is already beautiful in Bali. For me, what is beauty in Bali is the open mind. People just welcome everyone's positive thinking and open for any different cultures, because it's, Bali naturally is a melting pot. And we don't want these beautiful things change because of this event, the Bali bombing. We don't want people in Bali suddenly become very suspicious with other ethnics, become a narrow and overprotect themselves to people differences. So we have a lot of discussion with a community, with organization, with spiritual leaders, with the government, to keep what the beauty in Bali, to keep the open mind in Bali and not provoked by this kind of action and make Bali change into something that we don't want. So the lyric of Everyone Goes to Heaven, I extract from so many discussions with friends, with family, and also I volunteering in some campaign to keep the pluralism in Indonesia, how we handle the social conflict. But also I want to bring this issue into international level, so we create a song with English lyric. I'm very confident to making a strong lyric with Indonesian, but to make it in English, I asked my wife Lakota to help me to make the lyric more poetic and make sense in English while still keeping the strength of the ideas.
Let's hear Everyone Goes to Heaven.
Faith makes a man.
the Holy Land, but in the end.
Everyone Goes to Heaven is a satire about the concept of the existence of heaven and hell. So many misinterpretation in religion that people do what they think is good in order to get compensation. And the concept of heaven and hell is the compensation. You do good, you're going to heaven. You do bad, you're going to hell. What I believe, without religion, there are always good and bad people. But in the name of religion, people do an evil thing, which is they think it's good things. In this song, there is words, he's just a man, speak the same as others can. It's reminding us that right or wrong is made by social agreement or somebody told you this is right, this is wrong. But we have to remember that we as a human also have other ethics, kindness and unkind. And we just need to see ourselves, to ask ourselves. This become the consideration, not just thinking about right or wrong, but also thinking about this is kind or not kind. That's very simple for me. What you don't want people to do to you, don't do it to others.
Thanks, Robbie. You heard Gumbul at the start of the show talking about the time when the bomb hit. The band was supposed to have a gig that night. Gumbul and Dadang were on the way to their venue, but as the roads were blocked, they went to Made's house instead. Because the phone network was down, they were unable to reach Robbie and Made. So to end this heavy episode, I wanted to end on a lighter note. Here's Gumbul again.
I still remember a little bit funny situation on that. Made always doing something funny and unique. Everybody was so desperate and sad. His mother like, oh, Made, where is he? Where is he? We try the phone and cannot work. And then after half an hour later, we just heard the sound of... We thought it's another small bomb exploded. Suddenly, Made come with all the stock of beer in the bike, with all the beers, and, hey, I'm coming home. Suddenly, oh, fuck. Like, everybody just... Ask, what happening? What happened? Why you come late? He said, like, oh, the gig was canceled. It's pretty big explosion. They can't hear it from the beach. Everybody was running at the beach, and Made is just, see, everybody's panic. Everybody's gone. Why everybody don't save any beer? He just grabs some box of the beer and takes it to the bike and going home. Yeah, we're almost there. And we see directly what happened in the panic. Yeah, we all safe.
And if I knew what is right and what is wrong,
so that's it for today. Thanks for listening to A Soundtrack of Resistance. And join me for the next episode. We'll be talking about corruption. Through one of Navicula's biggest hits, Mafia Hukum, the legal mafia. A Soundtrack of Resistance is written and hosted by me, Eva Wojkowska, and produced by G'day Robbie, together with Gina Long, Andre Dananjaya, and Vanessa Harsamto. Sound designed by G'day Robbie, sound production and mixing by Tude Artasedana and Tegu Narakusuma. All music by Navicula. You can listen to Everyone Goes to Heaven and other Navicula songs on Spotify. Web design and artwork by Jason Sims, Penny Lane, and Major Tom. To learn more, visit soundtrackofresistance.net, where you can find more information about today's episode, as well as source and bonus material. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe via Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.